This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Are you ready?
Let's go.
From AMI Central.
Now circling in the neutral zone.
Here's the pitch on the way. 36 yards for the win.
This.
Here comes a big chance. The shot.
Is this the dagger? The neutral zone.
This is as good as it gets.
Now, here's your host, two-time Paralympian, Brock Richardson.
What's going on? It's time for another edition of The Neutral Zone. I am indeed your host, Brock Richardson, and we've made it to 2022. And making it with me this week is Claire Buchanan. Claire, how are you?
It's good to be back. 2022 is here, and I'm excited for what the year has in store for us.
Yes, I would agree with you 100%. Cameron is also joining us. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It seems like we've had a lot of good days of blue skies and weather. So I'm enjoying that every day when I look out of my apartment to see that. And yeah, like 22, let's go. This has got to be the good year. So let's go.
I know this is totally non-sports related, but what a way to end 2021 with losing the great Betty White. It was kind of the last gut punch of 2021 that we got. So that was a bit of unfortunate news, but great life and great person. Just I've been watching bloopers and things, and she was just hilarious to watch and be around. So may she rest in peace. But like I said, what a gut punch to the end of 2021, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you get a chance to go on YouTube to watch the Betty White bloopers of A Hot in Cleveland, I watched that the other day, and that was a good laugh. So if anyone needs a laugh right now, I highly suggest you check that out on YouTube.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you there. I think we might have watched the same ones. Claire, I have a question for you. How long does it take you when you're writing the date on a piece of paper to change from, in this case, 2021 to 2022?
That's a good question. It instantly brought me back to the days of high school and where most of your work and stuff were handwritten and a lot of scratch outs. I think it would take me a couple of weeks back in the day. Right now, everything's kind of on my laptop and everything. So luckily, I have the beautiful technology assistant of it'll correct me when I put the date wrong or something like that. So it's helping me get back into used to, like, it's not 2021 anymore. It's 2022, and it's helping me get into that mindset of it being a new year.
Yeah, I may or may not have written in 2021 on the first iteration of this script and then remembered, oh yes, we're in 2022. Let's kick off 2022 for the Neutral Zone with our headlines.
Joe Maddon, Hall of Famer coach and broadcaster, passed away at the age of 85. He holds the highest career winning percentage of any coach in the NFL with a percentage of .535. He may also be known to the younger generation for creating the Madden video game franchise.
For the first time in its 45-year history, the World Junior Hockey Championship was canceled due to the Omicron variant being present. The tournament was canceled after only 3 days of the competition when four athletes initially tested positive for the virus. It has been known since then that there was a total of eight individuals altogether that had the virus. And I gotta say, this is one of the favorite events of the year for me. It's always marked on my calendar, so it was sad to see it had to be canceled, but understandable given the circumstances.
NHL players will not participate in the Beijing 2022 Olympic Games due to the widespread of the Omicron variant. In replace of the Olympic Games, the NHL will take that 2 weeks to play catch-up on the 70-plus games that have already been postponed.
One of the biggest stars in tennis has been denied entry into Australia, where he'd hoped to defend his title in the Australian Open.
Novak Djokovic, one of the greatest tennis players in the world, blocked from entering Australia. The 20-time Grand Slam champion from Serbia traveled to Melbourne with a medical exemption to play in the season-opening Grand Slam, but his visa was abruptly cancelled.
All I can say is that the evidence for medical exemption that was provided was found to be insufficient.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, Djokovic has not publicly revealed his vaccination status, but has voiced opposition to compulsory COVID-19 vaccines. Derek Dennis, ABC News.
At the end of the day, if he is not, it's not even about being vaccinated. I guess it is. But to me, it's just a matter of if he's not following the rules or if his exemption is denied, then he has to be able to prove that what the information that he has is good enough. And right now it isn't. So for the sake of himself, if he isn't vaccinated, as well as all of the other players and coaches and staff and people watching the tennis tournament, it's for everyone's safety. So I agree with the decision of not letting him play.
Those are your headlines for this week. Let's check in on our Twitter polls and let's go way back to December the 18th. And as I'm looking at this Twitter poll, it's a bit ironic given that this event was canceled. But the question was, how do you think Team Canada will do at this year's World Junior Hockey Championships? 79% of you said gold, 14% of you said silver, and 7% of you said bronze, and 0 of you said no medal at all. This week's Twitter poll question is, given the state of the pandemic across the country and around the world, do you think the Olympics and Paralympic Games should run? Your answers are yes or no. Quick crack for both of you on this one. Start with you, Cameron.
I think that if people are in danger of being really sick and going into hospitals and ICUs, then the game shouldn't run.
I agree with you, Cam. I hate using the word canceled or just not running at all. Hopefully, if they do choose to not run them at this time, that it's just a postponement and that these athletes can compete once it's safe again.
We've been here before down this road when it comes to the Olympic and Paralympic Games, and I think we need to take into account the safety of athletes and people around them to make sure these games are going to run. And right now with the climate in China especially, I'm not so sure it's safe. But we'll see and we'll keep you posted. Coming up next, we're going to feature alpine skiing as our para sport this week. And grab a pen and paper because you'll need it. Stay tuned for that information next on The Neutral Zone. We'll be back.
A message for the Neutral Zone, call now 1-866-509-4545 and don't forget to give us permission to use your message on the air. Let's get ready to leave a voicemail.
Welcome back to The Neutral Zone right here on AMI Audio. I'm your host, Brock Richardson, joined by Claire Buchanan and Cam Jenkins. And as I said before the break, we're going to continue our series on featuring para sports right up until the Paralympics do take place, or so they are scheduled to take place. And this week we are going to talk about para alpine skiing. And Claire, you're going to kick it off with the background.
Thanks, Brock. Para-alpine skiing is practiced worldwide and features six disciplines. There's downhill, slalom, giant slalom, super G, super combined, and team events. With the combination of speed and agility, athletes will reach speeds of around 100 kilometers an hour. The sport was developed following the end of the Second World War when injured vets returned home. In 1948, the first para-alpine skiing courses were offered. And both the male and female athletes compete that have a physical impairment such as spinal injury, cerebral palsy, amputation, and vision impairments. The first documented championships for skiers with an impairment were held in, I hope I pronounced this properly, Bad Gastein in Austria in 1948, with 17 athletes taking part in that event. The introduction of sit ski allowed paraplegic and double above the knee amputee athletes to begin to compete. Now, the first Paralympic Winter Games took place in Sweden in 1976 and featured two alpine disciplines. They were slalom and giant slalom. Downhill was added to the Paralympic program in 1984, and Super G was added in 1994. Sit skiing was introduced as a demonstration sport at the 1984 Paralympics and became a medal event at the Games in 1988.
Very cool. And we know, as Claire mentioned, there are five events. We're going to start with downhill, and Cameron, you're going to take that one.
Yeah. So for the downhill, each athlete competes one run down the course, and it's their finishing time that determines the final order, and it's based on ascending time. So athletes, they ski down a long, steep course, and they must pass through a few number of gates. And if any of the gates are missed by the athlete, then they are disqualified.
Now, with slalom, each athlete competes two runs on the same day on different courses. Times from the two runs are added together to determine the final order based on ascending total time. It is a technical event over a shorter course than other events, but with a high number of gates that the athlete must negotiate. Again, if an athlete misses a gate, they are disqualified from the event.
And then if we move towards giant slalom, each athlete completes two runs on the same day but different course. The two runs are added together with the final time, and the time is based according on the technical time as well, with a longer course and fewer gates than the slalom. And same thing here, if gates are missed, you are disqualified.
And then the next one is the Super Giant Slalom, also known as Super G. And that's a speed event where athletes complete one run down the course with the, once again, the finishing time. It's based on ascending. And the course is generally shorter than the downhill, but it is longer than the slalom and the giant slalom.
A combined competition in which is represented the final result of two disciplines, usually one of either a downhill or Super G, and a single run of slalom. Super combined events, each athlete competes two runs on the same day on different courses, and times from the two runs are added together to determine the final order based on ascending total time.
And then we're going to move towards sport classes. We're going to start with LW 1-9, standing skiers. Let's talk about leg impairments. Sport class LW1, the class is allocated where athletes have an impairment that strongly affects both of their legs. For example, above the knee amputation with one or both legs, or significant muscle weakness in both legs.
And the next class is the LW2, and those skiers have a significant impairment in one leg. So some skiers, for example, have an impaired leg from birth, so you will see them ski with one ski only.
Classification LW3. This classification is for athletes who have a moderate impairment in both legs. They will ski with two skis and a prosthesis. some LW3 skiers have mild coordination problems or muscle weakness in both legs, or a below knee amputation in both legs.
So when we talk about class LW4, similar to skiers in LW2, these skiers have an impairment with only one leg, but with less activity limitation. A typical example is below the knee amputation with one leg. They will use two skis during the race, however.
Now we're going to get into the classification of arm impairments, and that's LW 5 to 7. And athletes in this sport class ski with an impairment in both arms. Some athletes have amputations and others just have limited muscle power or coordination problems. They will race down the slopes without ski poles.
Then we're going to move towards LW 6 and 8. Skiers have an impairment in one arm. Skiers will compete with one ski pole only.
Classification LW9. Skiers in this classification have an impairment that affects both their arms and their legs. Some skiers in this classification have coordination problems such as spasticity or some loss of control over one side of their body. Now, depending on their abilities, they will ski with one or two skis and one or two poles.
And now we're going to get into sport classes, which are the LW 10 to 12, and those are sit skiers. And I've personally sit skied myself, and it can be very hard on the arms and basically the core muscles. All sit skiers, they do have an affecting impairment of their legs. They are allocated to different sport classes depending on their sitting balance. So that is very important for acceleration and balancing during the races.
Classification LW10 skiers in this classification have no or minimal trunk stability. For example, due to either having a spinal cord injury or spina bifida. They therefore rely mainly on their arms and, like Cameron said, their core to maneuver the sit ski down the slope.
LW11, skiers have good abilities in their upper trunk, but very limited control in their lower trunk and hips, as it would be the case for skiers with lower spinal cord injuries.
And then we have the class LW12, and then that sport class includes skiers with normal or only slightly decreased trunk function and leg impairments. Skiers with leg impairments in sport classes LW1 to 4, they often fit into this sport class. So they actually have the choice where they can either choose if they want to go sit skiing, or they can do the standing skiing in the beginning of their career, and they can't change or they can't compete in both events.
Now switching over to skiers with vision impairment, starting with classification B1. Skiers are either blind or have very low visual acuity. To explain this, their level of visual acuity is such that the athlete wouldn't be able to recognize the letter E, which is 15 by 15 centimeters in size, from the distance of only 25 centimeters. During the race, they are required to wear eye shades while competing.
And now we move on to the sport class of B2. And that sport class profile includes athletes with a higher visual acuity than athletes competing in the B1 class. They are unable to recognize the letter E from a distance of 4 meters. Moreover, athletes with a visual field of less than 10 degrees diameter are eligible for this sport class.
Then we move towards B3, sport class B3 describes the least severe vision impairment for eligible for alpine skiing. eligible athletes either have a restricted visual field of less than 40 degrees diameter or a low visual acuity. And also, these individuals are eligible for a guide. In this case, the guide would be going down the hill with them as well. So that's that information.
Moving over to the actual equipment that these athletes use, the primary equipment used in the sport includes outrigger skis, sit skis, and mono skis, depending on both the classification and other equipment that may be used by skiers, including the guide skiers, cut down ski poles, orthopedic aids, or a prosthesis. For standing skiers, different class rules determine what sort of equipment is allowed in the competition. For example, an athlete might use just one pole, two poles, or no poles at all, or the variation between one or two skis. The rules for the equipment use in competition are set by the FIS and the IPC. There are minimum lengths for skis used in competition, with men's skis needing to be at least 165 centimeters, which is 65 inches long, and women's skis needing to be at least 155 centimeters, which is 61 inches long. Bindings used for the skis have a maximum height of 55 millimeters, which is 2.2 inches. Sit skis are designed for wheelchair users or other skiers with a form of paraplegia. Current sit skis include seat belts, and as skis for able-bodied skiers have evolved to specialize for the event, the skis that sit skiers use have also changed. Sit skiers use a specially designed ski called a mono ski. It is used by skiers with lower limb disabilities, including paralysis. A variation of the monoski exists for skiers with bilateral and above the knee amputations as well. The monoski uses the same skis used for able-bodied alpine skiing, adapted so that the skier sits on a chair attached to the ski via a spring. The monoski was first used at the Paralympic Games in 1988. A mono ski, specifically also known as a sit ski, consists of a molded seat mounted onto a metal frame. A shock absorber beneath the seat eases the ride on uneven terrain and helps in turning by maximizing ski to snow contact. A mono skier uses outriggers for stability, which an outrigger resembles a forearm crutch with a short ski on the bottom. In 1984, mono skiers took part in the 1984 Paralympic Winter Games as a demonstration sport. And in 1988, full medal categories were added for sitting skiers. And Cameron's going to cover standing skiers next.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for the standing competitors, outrigger skis can be used in some classifications. There are ski poles with small skis on the end. They assist a skier by balancing as they're skiing down the slopes and in moving uphill for short distances, enabling skiers to do the things like a climb, a slope, to get on a chairlift. Some of the other equipment people use are similar to able-bodied skiers as well. They gear up with sometimes special boots. They have helmets and ski suits and goggles. At the Paralympic Games, the equipment is prohibited from having advertisements on it. And yeah, that's pretty much it for that. Some of the boots, they may attach a little bit differently, or the boots may be a little bit different depending on the person's foot and the challenge that they may have in life as well.
So if we're talking again a little bit about athletes with visual impairments, they are allowed to be assisted by a skier down the hill with them. Guides who do not have a visual impairment, of course, will assist the skier down the hill by telling the skier where to go using a radio device. Skiers may have more than one guide through the course of a competition, but they are only eligible for a medal if they have been with the athlete for the duration of the event, and they do have to comply with all of their licensing that's done by the governing body. So that is a rundown of what we're talking about when we say paraskiing. Lots of information there. And of course, if you've missed any of it, go to our podcast. It will be there after the program. Coming up next, we're going to chat a little bit about some of the restrictions that have been posted by different provinces and how that's affecting the sporting world. We'll discuss right after the break here on the Neutral Zone. Stay with us.
And welcome back to the Neutral Zone AMI broadcast booth.
Play ball.
And we are set to get this ball game underway. The first pitch brought to you by Brock Richardson's Twitter account at Neutral Zone BR. First pitch, strike. And hey, gang, why not strike up a Twitter chat with Claire Buchanan for the Neutral Zone? Find her at Neutral Zone CB. And there's a swing and a chopper out to second base right at Claire. She picks up the ball, throws it over to first base for a routine out. And fans, there is nothing routine about connecting with Cam and Josh from the Neutral Zone. At Neutral Zone, Cam J and at JWatson200. Now that's a winning combination. And this Oregon interlude is brought to you by AMI Audio on Twitter. Get in touch with the Neutral Zone. Type in at AMI Audio.
Welcome back to the Neutral Zone right here on AMI Audio. I'm your host, Brock Richardson, alongside Cam Jenkins and Claire Buchanan. And there's been something that's been on my mind, and this is my first opportunity to speak about it because I missed my Monday sports report with Kelly and Ramya, as I normally do, because of the short week. But here, let's talk about it here in this situation. So we know that there is restrictions placed across the province. And I do want to say that I agree with these restrictions. However, I am a little perplexed at how things are being handled because of certain announcements that's been made. So let me explain. We now know that 1,000 people are allowed into buildings when we talk about sporting events in Ontario and other provinces as well. But that number really restricts to game operation people only. So there are no ticketed individuals. We have seen some family and friends that are with the bubbles with teams, but no paying fans. Now, I think where I'm getting a little bit confused is, here we are, and we've said now, in Ontario especially, that we're not eligible for PCR tests unless we are in the healthcare category or vulnerable person. But then you have to have two symptoms in order to get a test. So if we are not accurately keeping track of the pandemic, my question would be, why is it limited to 1,000 when we're seeing other situations like the malls, hair salons being reduced to 50% when sporting events have outright said, nope, we cannot do 50% anymore. We need to go down to 1,000. What say you guys on this? Are you as perplexed as me, or do you guys have a different take on this one? Start.
You know, I think that the more people that are in a stadium, in a hockey rink, as an example, that's when the spread could happen. So for the more seats that you have available in the stadium, I think that's why it's not allowed half for there and why they say 1,000 people. Because when you're talking about a lot of the other businesses, you're talking about malls or you're talking about hair salons or wherever, there's no way that you're going to be able to pack 1,000 people in there. So I think that's why they have 1,000 for stadiums and rinks personally.
Yeah, I mean, it's confusing no matter how you look at it. As someone that enjoys going to sporting events and also enjoys going to my local gym frequently, it's confusing to see numbers like 1,000 people can be in an arena all at one time. And like Cameron said, like, the malls are packed right now, and it blows my mind that we are allowed to pack in a mall and shop and go to the food court. And me, as someone that relies on physical activity as a big part of my mental health, I can't go to the gym and work out for an hour where I've been doing it safely. And I know that the gyms that I've been going to recently have been really safe. I've seen everyone cleaning their equipment and everyone's keeping their mask on and they're not letting large groups inside. And so to see numbers like having 1,000 people all packed into one space, no matter how big it is, it's confusing. And again, it's upsetting to me personally, as someone that looks to these things as a way of keeping my mental health in a good state.
Yeah, and Claire, I actually had this conversation through social media, with a friend about that exact same thing, because I also have a gym that I enjoy going to, and it's disheartening not being able to go because, as you know, everyone knows, I've talked about my mental health and anxiety on the show before as well. And the point that was brought to me, that is a very good point, is that in a lot of gyms and restaurants, people aren't wearing their masks. And I know at the, gyms that I've seen or gone to, or you see on social media, a lot of people aren't wearing their masks, and the hospitals are so understaffed and also overrun with people being in the ICU or hospitalizations due to COVID. They need to get those numbers down. And so that's why, it's my understanding, they're targeting places that you don't have your masks on, because this is an airborne disease. So as much as it is hard, and I would really want to be able to go to the gym, and I can understand the reasoning why they're closing some of those places where you don't wear your mask all the time.
Yeah. And I mean, go ahead, Claire, go ahead.
At the same time, like when you go to the mall, like right now, everyone's sitting in the food court eating, having their mask off, like, That's the exact same thing, but in a multitude of numbers. I think malls should be shut down, and if they're going to close gyms like that, I strongly believe that places like the Eaton Center shouldn't be open right now. I know a lot of people have jobs and they rely on that, but if they're thinking about public safety and putting our health first, having the mall open and the food court open and people just kind of having free range of that space is, I don't think it should be allowed at all.
Yeah. And I 100% agree with you. And it's my understanding that the food courts aren't supposed to be open. And if people are sitting there with their masks off and eating, there should be some sort of security moving them out and not doing that, because, everyone needs to be basically have their mask on during this time, because it is airborne. So if that's what's going on, then they need to stop that in the food courts. Absolutely.
Now, let me present this idea, because literally it just dawned on me just before Claire started speaking. Could this be the fact that if we've gone down to 1,000 people at a sporting event, and most of those people are game op and family and friends, as noted. But could this also be a factor because at a sporting event, what do? You have a drink, you have popcorn, you have hot dogs, you have all these types of things. And so what are you doing when you're eating those things? You don't have your mask on. So as we're talking about this, it's starting to click in my mind going, well, if you do allow even 50%, even 25, people are still going to say, well, I can go and get, you know, Coke, as Cameron points out, wobbly pop, whatever the case may be, and keep my mask off. Now, the alternative to that is close the concessions, but how many people are going to go if part of what you're going for is the eating, the drinking, the partaking? Do you guys
and that's their choice at the end of the day, Brock. And to my recollection, I think that they do have to have concessions closed when you do go. And then if people don't want to go because the concessions are closed, are they really a baseball fan or are they really a hockey fan? Like I'm not worried about those people that don't go just because concessions are closed.
Yeah, I mean, no. I was at the championship game for the PWHPA. And I went there expecting to be able to have a drink and buy a hot dog and watch the game. But that wasn't the case. They actually, the entire Scotiabank Arena, I couldn't get anything. Everything was closed. And I think that's how they're operating moving forward. I'm not too sure, but this was 2 weeks ago or even maybe 3 weeks ago that I was there. And I realized it was middle of the day, but I wasn't able to get anything at the game.
Yeah, and I mean, I went to a movie theater not that long ago, and it's the same thing. You were not allowed to take anything into the actual movie because you had to have your mask on the entire time. Now, you could leave the movie and then get stuff and go home, but you could not take it in. Now, here's a question for both of you. If the capacity limits were allowed to be at 50%, would any of us go? My initial answer would be no. You guys? Cameron?
I would go, but I would want to have an N95 mask on the entire time. I went to a concert over the summer. It's the first time I've been to a concert in more than 2 years. And I had my N95 mask on the entire time. So would I go? Yeah, probably, as long as I had the good N95 masks and not a lot of the cloth masks that are going around, because those are now shown that they're not good enough to stop the virus. So N95 mask, then, yeah, I'd think about going.
I wouldn't go right now, but this this question brought me back to when you guys asked me if I was offered courtside seats to an NBA game, would I show up? And I said, yeah, I'd put a hazmat suit on me. So it might be time to invest in that hazmat suit if we want to see any sports games anytime soon. But I honestly, it's if they go at 50%, I don't think that they'll have the sales of food and drink. But again, like Cameron suggested a great idea, like just up your mask game, and they're proven to be safe and effective. So at the end of the day, it's up to you.
Yes, it is. It is absolutely a personal choice, and it's what you're comfortable with out there and, you know, moving forward. But I think at this moment in time, I think that having it down to 1,000 people, even if it is game op people and select few after that, is the important thing to do. My only confusion in bringing up this segment is because we're not really getting as accurate of a picture of the pandemic because we've stopped testing here in Ontario beyond the 100,000 a day mark, which is still showing to be very, very high rates of transmission of the Omicron variant. Coming up next, we're going to chat a little bit about some drama in the NFL that has taken place recently. Antonio Brown left the game in the middle of the third quarter. Why? We shall let you know. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Welcome back to this program we call The Neutral Zone on AMI Audio. I'm your host, Brock Richardson, joined by Claire Buchanan and Cam Jenkins. Well, I'm really excited to delve into this conversation that we've got on tap here.
And if you missed it, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers played a game against the New York Jets this past Sunday. In a bizarre sequence of events, Antonio Brown was seen leaving the field of play, removing his jersey and shirt while waving goodbye to the crowd. And there are a few different reports and reasons why this may have occurred. Just to give you a little bit of background, Antonio was dealing with a nagging ankle injury, and he felt that he was unable to play. And he says that Bruce Arians wanted him to play, and he didn't feel like he should, and that is what started it. Another reason is the coach wanted him to, didn't want him to play, and Antonio Brown wanted to play. And the third one is that Antonio Brown had some stats to get in order to get some bonuses. And I'm not talking about $100 bonuses. I'm talking about a few $100,000 bonuses. He had 2 weeks left to do it. Antonio Brown has since come out and said that he was forced to play and didn't feel comfortable. And Bruce Arians was quite aggressive about it. Bruce Arians so far has just come out and said he's no longer part of the team. Tom Brady came out and acknowledged the situation and said, I think that this goes far beyond the field of play and Antonio Brown needs to get the help that he may require. Unfortunately, he will not be with our team. Cameron, what say you about this entire situation?
It's confusing with he said, and another person saying this, like, I don't think about the bonuses and such. I don't think that's a factor because Antonio said that he wasn't able to play, Antonio Brown. So to me, about the bonuses, and I think there's a few $100,000 for different bonuses that equaled up to like $1 million or $2 million or who knows what it was. So I don't think that's a factor because Antonio Brown is the one saying he couldn't go in. And I saw on Twitter where Antonio Brown, he ended up showing a text message from his coach apparently that was showing that he was hurt and the coach was, you know, okay with that or kind of understood that. So that's apparently why Antonio Brown went off. But like to go off the way he did, to throw his shirt in the stands and other things. And like that, I just don't understand. And I just don't think that's sportsmanlike. And that's not being a good team player at the end of the day. So, you know, you want your team to win. You don't want to be the focus of attention. But then apparently there's, you know, mental health issues. And if he does have mental health issues, he has to be the one to be able to go for help for that, to be able to, you know, only he can do that. So I don't know. It's just one big mess as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, with the way media is, I don't know who's right and who's wrong. And maybe it's somewhere in the middle.
I think you hit that right on the head, Cameron, is that it's not just one person that's involved here. I think we need to talk a little bit more about what the coach did. At the end of the day, as an athlete myself, I don't ever want to be forced to play or do anything of that sort, especially if I'm injured. And I've brought that up to my coach. And it shows just poor coaching and poor care of your athletes. It's a team sport. And yes, he's Antonio Brown, but you need all of your athletes to be healthy. And if they're not healthy, they shouldn't be playing. So I think this has a lot more responsibility that needs to be put on the actions of the coach. And anyone struggling with mental health or anything like that, like Cameron mentioned, it's up to you to kind of speak up and say, this is what I need and this is what I'm going through. And hopefully he does have the support around him to move forward, because, I mean, you never want to lose control of your emotions like that. And seeing the way that he exited himself out of the game and kind of made that statement just shows that he himself does have he has a lot of work to do on himself. And these are professional athletes, and you got to be professional both on and off the field. And if you choose to leave that field, you also need to do that in a professional manner and kind of keep, what'd you say? The drama kind of behind closed doors, because that's not good for anybody. He's going to have a hard time. I think continuing his career, teams have already spoken up saying that they're not going to look to recruit him. So it's sad to see that this happened, and hopefully all parties involved realize what they need to do in order to become better, and so that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, I think that all parties here need to take a bit of a responsibility. One of the things that I heard on another sports talk show was that he was given an injection of a painkiller into his ankle that is highly suggested by the NFL not to use said painkiller. If that story does come out, that could be a real problem for Bruce Arians and the staff of the Buccaneers, because if that's true, and it's only been a report that I've heard, but if that's true, that could be a real problem, because apparently the NFL has said whatever this product was should not be used for pain management on or off the field in the NFL. So that's an interesting take there. Cameron, do you think that Antonio Brown should get another chance at the NFL, especially if it's proven eventually down the line that he was right?
Seems like a bit of a loaded question. Do I think he should be given another chance? If the evidence shows that he was hurt and that, you know, he shouldn't be playing, because I think every athlete plays hurt. But if it shows that, like, he shouldn't have been playing or he was in so much pain, then, yeah, I think that he should be given another chance to play on another team, because that's not necessarily his fault at the end of the day. If he's lying, and, you know, he wasn't necessarily hurt and he was just upset that, you know, he wasn't going in for certain plays, or I think I heard something about there was a starter that was out, but now they're kind of back in and taking his minutes away. If it's something like that, well, then, you know, for him to act like that and to just kind of throw a hissy fit, then no, I don't think he should get another shot in the NFL. But he's such a good player that I think we all realize that, you know, for what all of the other players that have been so much worse, Michael Vick and the dog situation that happened, and, you know, some athletes, NFL athletes beating their wife or spouse, he's going to get another shot.
See, these athletes should get another shot, but they need to show that they're owning up to the situations that they essentially caused themselves. All those athletes that you just mentioned before made some bad choices, and we all make bad choices. And at the end of the day, it's up to him, and it's up to all these athletes, including this coach, to speak up and own up to their part in whatever unfolded.
Claire, before we close here, I just want to give you a little bit of an opportunity to talk about Aaron Rodgers and the MVP. We just have a little under 3 minutes.
Yeah. This is a sticky situation for me, being a Green Bay Packers fan and being an Aaron Rodgers fan for quite some time. It's heartbreaking to see kind of this other side to him. And at the end of the day, he's putting up numbers that do have him in the conversation of MVP once again. But I've seen comments from other broadcasters and on shows that they're now bringing into consideration his character and what decisions he's been making with COVID and getting vaccinated and all that stuff. And it's interesting because I don't think before now that someone's character like this has been so much in the spotlight when talking about an MVP race in any sport.
And it should be at the end of the day, I don't think. Apparently, the reporter that brought it all out in saying that he's not going to vote for him for MVP, he's the guy where the quarterback or Rodgers said that he's never even been interviewed by this guy or seen this guy or ever talked to this guy. So he's just basing his argument based on COVID and not even anything to do with his play. So
I do think that the MVP will be given out based on numbers, but it's an interesting take that we should be looking at the character all around, because that is the athlete as a whole versus just the numbers they put up. That is the end of our show for this week. I'd like to thank Claire Buchanan, Cam Jenkins. I'd also like to thank our technical producer, Matt Agnew. Our technical supervisor is Paula Dineen, and our manager of AMI Audio is Andy Frank. And of course, I am your host and producer of The Neutral Zone, Brock Richardson. Be safe and have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.